Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
I think we need to start with the big news of the week, which is that you had your new novel cover reveal, title reveal, existence reveal.
Existence reveal.
Today. The best reveal of all, existence reveal.
Existence is revealed. So, well, I'd hinted at it. I mean, some people might have picked up on that, but I had not said too much because, you know, in publishing, you don't want to... You never want to overcommit to promising something and have it not work out.
And your publisher wants to, you know, have the ability to control how it does its marketing and rollout of its stuff that it's doing.
Sure. Yeah. So you want to make a splash. Hopefully that happened. I don't know yet when the pre-orders for it go live. You can, I will note, for listeners of the Six Colors Subscriber Podcast, you are among my favorite people. That if you want to pre-order it directly from my publisher, you can go do that at the Angry Robot site. You can pre-order an ebook there, and their ebooks are DRM free, which I know is important to a lot of people. And I think they give you both Kindle and EPUB formatted versions too. So it's pretty great. But you know, the rest of those stores, Amazon and Barnes and Noble and Kobo and stuff, will all follow
those stores
in short order. The stores, as we call them.
Yeah. So this is. This is the book that you wrote. So I have been, you know, behind the scenes observing this going on. This is the book. So you wrote this book. There are a bunch of firsts here. I think this is your first where you had a real direct deadline where you wrote it under contract, right? Is that right?
Or was second.
That second book second. That you wrote
Aleph
under contract.
Aleph was also written under contract because it was a two-book contract.
Right. Bayern. So this is the difference is you had to write this not in a cafe because you wrote this during the pandemic.
Entirely, I think 100% in my house.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I even worked on it like on the couple short vacations we took during quarantine last year. I'm not sure that I did. Yeah. So I think at the very least, like 99% written in my house, but probably 100% written in my house.
Yeah. So that's a big weird workflow change. And we've talked about how you used to pop into the cafe and do work for
in
us
the before
and others
times.
And book. Well, yeah, I was thinking about this the other day about because I keep Starbucks keeps emailing me. Come back.
Not now, Starbucks.
And it's like, you know, one day, because I did enjoy that. That was a really good change of pace for me, mostly in the winter. In the summer, my change of pace is generally go outside. And I sit in a camp chair in my backyard under my redwood tree and I write and it's fine. But in the winter, one of the things I would do would be to go to Starbucks and write like my Macworld column. And it was just a nice change of pace. And maybe one day we'll get back there. But like it is, you know, you really did a lot of work at Forge, your local cafe, which is lovely.
Yeah.
And
it's a very nice place.
And so it had to be a real work shift to not be able to go there.
It is weird, yeah, because I think there is some context switching that happens, you know, when you get out of your familiar environments, right? Mm-hmm. I think it does free your mind up. And I think that's one of the things that everybody suffered a little bit in the pandemic.
For sure.
Is just not even being able to, like, you know, it doesn't even have to be a thing where it's like I couldn't go away, you know, for vacation or whatever, so much as like I can't
just got
go
the one
to
context.
These other places. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And for those of us who work at home, it's even harder because, you know, we're already used to, in some ways, context switching. But I feel like then it's like, oh, now you're just home 100% of the time.
100%. Yeah. So I mean, I'm a believer in that. I talked about that on various podcasts. I think when we were doing Free Agents, I talked about it there. But the idea that just being in a different place or having anything different can really change, I think, especially if you're doing creative work, but I think in general, if you're doing work, it can make yourself more productive just by providing that something is different. And it's one of the reasons why I do a lot of writing on the iPad is that I sit at my Mac all day and then I go to the iPad and it's a different context. And then it's a different physical context. If I'm outside or at the bar or even like sitting on the couch, it's a different context, and that all helps kind of like, you know, human brains are funny. Like I remember reading about how if you've ever forgotten something, step back through the door you just stepped through.
Right. Yep.
Because your brain does, like, stepping through doors is a cue for your brain to like push things out of memory. And if you step back through the door to go back to where you were when you were thinking of it, it will often come back And that's just ridiculous.
But the number of times we've all walked into a room and been like, "Why did I walk into this room again?"
Yeah. And then, so my tip is, it really works. Go back where you were, and it'll come back to you, right? So, you know, anyway, there's a lot of things about how our minds work that seem very strange, but you can, if you figure out like something that works for you, you can maybe improve your productivity or your creativity or what have you.
Right. I mean, I almost always concentrate, like you mentioning writing on the iPad away from the Mac, like. I pretty much never, I don't think I write any fiction on my iMac. It's all on my laptop and on rarer cases, my iPad.
Right.
And it's always been that way. And I think, again, because it's just, there's something about the laptop to me signals like, all right, time to do this kind of work. And sitting down at the iMac is like a different sort of thing.
I got the new laptop, so.
Right, or the M1 Air, which has been great. And it's, you know, I mean, the biggest context which I get now is sometimes I take like one of my camp chairs out to the porch and I like sit on the front stoop and I work there, which is helpful sometimes when you're like struggling to come up with like an idea or you're trying to crystallize something that you're working on and you're like, I'm staring at the same wall, you know, behind my computer or whatever. Sometimes you need to just move and jumpstart that brain.
So now without revealing too much, I'm going to also say you're about to move.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have a big context change, and it'll be interesting to see how you discover spaces indoors and outdoors that work for you. And you know, I think anybody who's been through something like that, you probably are going to take a little bit of a productivity hit as you figure out where your places are best for your productivity.
Right. I think it's going to be interesting because for the first time in a long time, I feel like I will have many more potential contexts because it's a much larger home. We're moving from a one-bedroom apartment to a four-bedroom house, which is a big jump.
Yeah, with a backyard.
And I will have an office there, which will be a bit smaller than my current office, but will also be a dedicated office as opposed to right now where it's an office and the room that everything kind of gets dumped in.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to having like a space that is like entirely, you know, my space that I can set up exactly for the purposes that I want. But as you said, it's going to take some time to figure out exactly how that works. And in the meantime, I'll have to adjust and find other ways of working for things. And, you know, some of it's just as simple as like, well, you know, we will acquire new furniture and that will open up new spaces.
Yeah,
a
right.
Chair moves to this room or a couch shows up in that room. You know, we'll have different places that there is a hammock already. I have not spent very much time in it.
It's
a hammock
writing.
That my wife bought me a hammock for my birthday, ostensibly, and you can put a bet on who uses it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me.
It's not a really good writing place.
It's a little awkward. It's a little awkward because I think you need a little more back support,
yeah,
I think.
But that's why the camp chairs are good. See, we're covering it all here. Yeah. So it's called the Nova Incident. That was not its original title.
Nope, and if you were eagle-eyed and saw the link in to the Angry Robot page, you may have noticed the original title in there, which I've asked them to fix.
But that's okay. It's a little Easter egg. Like, it used to be called this, but it's not anymore.
I think I can easily say that every single book that I have had published has the original title has not survived.
Mm.
Every single one has started with a different title.
Let's see, there was Resurrection Men, there was Break the Bank.
Yep. Resurrection Men, I mean, briefly called Sons of Caledonia, you might remember.
That was my favorite version.
I know. Break the Bank was the original title for Bayern Agenda, and the original title for the Aleph Extraction was The Quell Affair.
Ah.
Quella, if you want to call it German, Quelle.
Yes.
And somebody argued that it's unpronounceable. I won't say that Aleph is a lot better, given the various pronunciations I've heard. I think this may, as I was just chatting with one of our members over at The Incomparable, I think this may be my first title that is pretty straightforward pronunciation-wise. I don't know if there are alternate pronunciations, but I feel like there's that's good. I won't have to constantly correct people. Yeah.
And I think this is a better title.
I know, and you just, you know, it was the spoiler behind the scenes. You suggested, I think, at least some variation of it when I was brainstorming new titles.
Yeah, I mean, I was participating in that, but it's a little bit like doing covers of Macworld back in the day, which is, you know, everybody's just suggesting everything, and something comes out at the end, and you're like, oh, nice. And, you know, I think it was we had a little real group effort on that one, but I think it's good, and it looks good, and those covers all pop. They're all of a kind, but they're also all pretty good. And this is a city on fire and a space station. And I can tell you, having read the book, accurate.
Relevant. Yeah. Yeah. I like when stuff relevant stuff shows up on the covers. The biggest thing for me in having all these books was maintaining that, like, you know, from the design, it's all the, like, consistent design. And I think it really works. I redesigned my Twitter header this morning to have each one of the Thayer and Aleph and Nova in there.
Oh.
And I just think it's very, it looks cool when you put them all next to each other, I think.
Oh, I agree.
And I don't have a physical copy of the book. We're still too early for that. But when I eventually get to stack that up with the others, I'm hopeful that it will look really good.
And
so
eventually your first novel will revert to you and you can commission a cover that fits.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see how that happens. But that would be great. I would love to do a reissue of that someday if it's popular enough. You know, it's funny. I was in a bookstore over last weekend out in Western Massachusetts. And I was perusing the shelves and I found both, you know, when they do, like, you know, when an author gets far enough along that they go back and, like, reissue all their work and often do, like, a nice version of it where all the covers are kind of the same flavor. There are really great recent paperback editions of both John le Carré and Elmore Leonard's work that have these really nice, like, kind of simple but, like, elegant covers. And I was like, if I ever get to the point where, like, all my stuff gets reissued with, like, just like a nice matching cover set, I will be great. I'll be really excited about that. But that's probably a ways off at this point. We'll try to get rid of, you know, try to sell through these first copies before we move on to the eventual reissue.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. It's funny, I was just, I've been doing a lot of library books this summer, ebooks from my library. And I had to push back a hold on a John le Carré novel, because I was reading his son's novel that's 800 pages long. And I thought that was really funny that I had Nick Harkaway and John le Carré in my library queue at the same time. Father and son.
That's some nice synergy right there.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I've talked about that Gnomon on Upgrade briefly, and it's the same thing. And I didn't mention it by name. People are like, what was that novel you mentioned? I'm like, ah. Because it's one of those things where I loved it. I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads. I loved it. It's also 800 pages long and incredibly dense, and I am reluctant to recommend it to anyone, but I loved it.
I found my copy as I was packing up my books, and I have it in hardcover.
That's going to weigh up a bit.
It wasn't as heavy as I thought. You mentioned how long it was. I was like, oh, this isn't... And then I remembered, I think, one of the reasons I stopped reading it for a little while is because the text was very small. And I was like, oh, maybe I should get an ebook version. Yeah,
there's
and
two
try
versions. There's two threads. There's sort of like the main narrative thread, and then there's this sort of visions that the main character has. And at least in the ebook version, those were a smaller typeface, so I had to crank up the font
for
those,
right.
Which I think choosing a font size difference is a mistake for something like that. I think you should find, but you can't set whole chapters in italic or something like that. You can't do that. In the book, you can change the font. Yeah. But on an ebook, that's harder. Anyway,
that's true.
Congratulations on your launch.
Thank you. I'm very excited, and I saw at least one person online referred to as a trilogy. I will say, as far as to say, not in the sense that it's three books. Yes, in the sense that the story tells a complete story in three books. No, I would not, hold your breath on that.
It's a continuing series.
It's a continuing series. Hopefully, there are as of yet no plans for another book, but there's always the possibility, especially if this book does well. So
And I know that authors are often coy, and they're like, I don't know. We'll see what happens next. But I think we can authoritatively state here that you have not written the next book.
That is correct. I have not written it. It has not been sold,
so
any of that. So
buy Dan's books,
buy this
folks,
one.
And then
you
can
buy all the
more
books, and I can write more in this series. Books. And there's always other stuff to work on, too. I did a Q&A over it, Sci-Fi Now, along with the cover reveal. And I hinted at a couple other things that I worked on, including one that I know you read.
Yeah,
and
I was excited to see you plug your other
stuff. I want
to
plug it because I love that book so much, and I have a deep, deep love for it, and I would love to find a home for it. And I feel like, well, maybe I can make other people excited about it, and that'll help in the long run. So
I'll tell you
we'll
see. That people who are into Apple stuff, it is an urban fantasy mystery novel, but it has very much... I guess I'll just say that our readers and listeners will recognize the references
Yes. Yeah.
Put it that way.
It's the thing that I have written that is the closest to the stuff that is in like my work life,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed pulling from that. I think it's a lot of fun. Fingers
like
crossed. We'll see.
I like that one.
Hopefully we'll find a home for it.
Let's see. This was a real... So we're talking about your book. I mean, that was the news of the week. There was very little, I think, going on this week. I wrote a piece at Macworld about how I thought, which is similar to a piece I wrote a few years ago, but I feel like it 3 years later, it's worth stating it again, which is that Apple pulled SharePlay from the betas this week. And they said to developers, it's not going to ship. And in fact, developers can download like a developer entitlement that basically unlocks it again so that they can continue to work on it. But it's not for people and it won't ship. And my piece at Macworld this week was basically good, like good. This is something that Apple has been doing for a little while. I came up with there's a whole list of features that have been announced and delayed by Apple in recent years. Portrait mode, AirPlay 2, messages in the cloud. Like, we've seen features get yanked during the summer from what Apple's working on. I wish Apple would be more upfront about basically saying, here's what we're doing this year, and not guaranteeing things for the fall and then pulling them over the summer. I think that maybe it's a little troublesome when your failures to have a feature progress are in public like this, but so be it. I mean, Safari this time also has been one of those cases where they're sort of just making changes in public. But I love the maturity of Apple to say, we're not going to ship this thing that's totally broken and inflict it on our users.
There's the right level of caginess to be, right? Like, I think over the time, as you point out, lots of the other features that they have put out end up in subsequent point releases. And that's okay, because a lot of times it's like, well, you know, iOS 14 or iOS 15 is the whole operating system inclusive in some ways. And, you know, sometimes later stuff comes down the pike that they haven't announced yet and they roll out in future updates, like when they did like the Apple Card family sharing earlier this year and stuff like that. But I think you're right in that you could at least say coming this fall, and maybe some of it is they just don't know, you know, what stuff will make the cut and what stuff won't make the cut until they're a little further along. But I have to believe that in this case, I think at least part of it is strategic. I mean, SharePlay is a big feature, but it is also a feature that relies heavily upon third-party integration in order to feel compelling. Like, you want to know that your partners, and they listed all those partners that have committed to doing it, like Disney Plus and I think HBO and a bunch of other folks were on the list. But, you know, committing to do it doesn't mean that you've already implemented it, right? It still means you got to do the work of building the code. And while you have like 2 or 3 months to do that, it may not be enough, especially if Apple's iterating on bugs at the same time. So they should have known ahead of time that SharePlay was a thing that was probably going to show up in, I don't know, October or November.
I guess there was a little bit of wish casting going on there where they're like, well, we think we can make it across the finish line, and then maybe it turned out. I get why they wanted to promote it, because it looks good and it's part of their narrative. They could have, if they had known that things were going slower, and maybe they didn't know, they could have said, coming later this fall, you know, SharePlay will be a part of this. There were, I will say, this is a progression for Apple, because for the first time, so people, you know, in the press get PDFs that are like reviewer's guides or preview guides in the case of the betas. And for the first time, I noticed a specific in June at WWDC a feature marked as won't be there when it ships. And that was the enhanced version of Memory Movies on the Mac in Photos. Like, they demoed it on stage on iOS, and like these interactive memory movie things that look actually quite clever and cool. And it's announced for the Mac, but they said, yeah, it's not going to be there at launch. And I thought that was refreshing, because it was a little infuriating, but also kind of refreshing for them to already know there was no way that it was going to ship on the Mac in time. And it's like, that's fine.
And I think that there's a good argument, as you said earlier, the maturity of the platform and being able to also direct your resources, right? If you know certain features aren't going to ship until later in the fall, it means rather than shipping an OS that's full of a dozen half-implemented, half-broken features, you can ship an OS with half a dozen well-implemented features, right? Like, if you feel like your hope is the stuff that you choose to release, if it's a smaller subset, will be more solid when it comes out, and then it will take more time, and you sort of gradually roll out other features as you're able to lock them down once you've, you know, released an initial release that has like sort of the groundwork laid. So one hopes that is the kind of thing you will go for. It obviously doesn't always happen that way, but I like the idea of rolling stuff out over the course of the year and saying, look, iOS 15, iOS, macOS, all this stuff is kind of a work in progress, right? Because software is a work in progress. It's not like a book, for example, that you put out and you just, synergy. And it just goes, right? Like every once in a while, you might get a reprint or you might get to fix some typos in new edition, et cetera. But for the most part, you put it out there, or a movie, or
once you ship it, it's done.
It's done, right? I mean, software has always been living and evolving because that's the nature of the game. So just acknowledging that and going like, look, iOS 15 is what we're doing from basically September to, you know, June or so. New features will come throughout the year. Plus, it's fun to get new features in the middle of the year, too, I think. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked in the past, too, about the Playdate, the Panix handheld, and right, how they're doing the games like every, you know, week or two. And it's like, I like that idea of having new stuff. It's like the weekly drop for TV shows. Like, ooh, what new feature will come out this week or something? And I don't know. I think it's cool to have the idea of stuff sort of an ongoing set of updates rather than just the big dump in September and everyone tries to sort through like all the stuff that's there and half of the stuff gets lost because there's so much other stuff and, you know, doesn't get discovered or whatever. I don't know. I think having that longer cycle is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I that's why I wanted to write this post, because, you know, so much of this is like, oh, Apple screwed that one up. They're delaying this thing. And I wrote a version of this same column 3 years ago. But I just wanted to say, like, no. You don't understand. This is good. This is good. it's kind of buggy. This is good. The FaceTime changes, part of me still thinks that the FaceTime changes aren't all going to be there at launch, because I haven't checked FaceTime the last few weeks, and I need to do some more of that. But it was also not doing great in terms of stability. And again, it's fine. Like, I think it's very grown up of Apple to say, what's more important than us shipping everything we announced in June is that when we ship an OS update, it doesn't break people's phones or force them to try something that actually doesn't have a good experience. I think the right choice is have it be a good upgrade experience, and the new features will continue to roll in when they're ready. That is the way it should be done, and that's the way they're doing it. And we can quibble with some of the details of the rollout and how things are messaged and whether they're exerting enough discipline in order to know what realistically is going to ship on time. I get that there are bumps in the road, but I do wonder if they are also, some people are sort of sandbagging, and other people we can do it. We can do it. We can't do it. Right. Until the summer comes. The Safari thing is the other funny thing, that all happened a different kind of thing, because they're going to ship Safari changes, but they've designed a lot of their designs. They've defanged a lot of their changes, and it seems like they've reached a place with the iPhone version of Safari that I think is a much better place, where they've brought back the toolbar at the bottom, but they have moved by default the address bar down to the bottom in a way that it doesn't overlap content, but it does give you the ability to more quickly with your hand, without having to, you know, because of tall phones and stuff, you can swipe around to different tabs and all that. And I think if they had announced that feature at WWDC, everybody would have been like, oh, interesting. But they got there. Right. They got there
in
this
the
week.
End.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I think even on the iPad, it's better. It's not perfect. And I hope there's a little more work to be done there. But like, I don't entirely agree with what they've done, but like, they've addressed the biggest usability problems, which is like legibility. Like, the tabs are much more readable and you can tell which one is selected. And that was the most important thing.
Right. Yeah. I'm very pleased with the changes that have been made for the most part. I find the iPhone version to be, I think, better, although it amuses me greatly that they just have an option to switch it back in there, because that feels like giving up in some ways. Like, I understand it's not going to be the default, right? They're going to make everybody at least try the bottom bar, but then they have the option of being like, look, if you really hate it, you can go back. It's fine. In the same way they did this on the iPad too, which I find hilarious, right? Because it has you can go back to the compact toolbar where it's just, there's no separate address bar. As a preference, and that will again probably be the default, because if it's not, no one's going to turn it on. But I think overall that process kind of ended up where I think it needed to be, and I think they saved the best stuff and managed to make the stuff that was less friendly go away without making it look too much like they had just entirely walked it back. So I think of all of them, the iPad one is the one that I like the least. Mac one is still, I think both the Mac and the iPad ones, they don't look great. They work fine for the most part, but I just don't love the look. And some of that is also, they also made a preference for the thing where it bleeds the color into the title bar. So there's a lot of like optional walking back stuff there. So take from that what you will, I guess.
Yeah, I think the difference is if you make it, what the default is matters. So like on the Mac and the iPad, the mushing it all together is no longer the default.
Right.
And I think that is their acknowledgement that they were prioritizing something over legibility that should not have been. I think what's interesting is the alternate approach, which is we're going to do this thing, but we're going to let you turn it off. Because that's sort of saying we think this is the best, but we know from feedback that not everybody likes it, and we still think it's the best, so we're going to let you turn it off if you hate it. Which I think is that should be how it is. Like, if you have a feature that you think is better, you should go out with it. Like, I said on Upgrade when we first talked about Safari 15 that the last thing I wanted is for Apple to just sort of cowardly and say, well, you can turn it off. It's like, well, wait a second. Right. Do you believe in this or not? We put it over there. You can turn it on if you want. It's the worst, right? Because now you've basically made it go away. Like, you should stand by the things that you think are net better, even if some people will be bugged by them. You have to decide what that is. And so I think they've decided, some people are going to be bugged by it at the bottom and they're like, you can put it at the top if you want. And some people are going to be bugged by the colors and they're going to say, you can turn those off if you want. But
yeah, I think the only thing that surprised me about the putting at the top thing is that it's so surfaced. If you tap and hold on the address bar, you can just, it's in there. It's not in the settings app, right? Like that's, it's not like a thing you got to go somewhere else and figure it out. It's like, oh no, it's right there. Because I guess they are like worried people will get really upset. Like I know, I can already hear the voices of the people who are switching in September and being like, wait,
what is this?
What the hell is going on? It's like picturing like my mom or my wife coming to me and being like, why is this broken? Why is it at the bottom? And they're like, all right, so this is what happened. And we'll see. Maybe you can convince them to try it for like a week or something and just be like, well, give it a try. See if you like it. If not, you can switch back. But I think a lot of people are just going to be like, no, I'm just putting this back. Like I was shocked at one point to hear the number of people I know who stuck with the old style scrolling on the Mac when they switched to the natural scrolling in Lion. And I'm surprised by people who, I don't want to out them on the podcast, but like longtime Mac users who are like, nope, I'm not switching. And it's like, I can understand that, but I at least gave it a try for a week. And after a week, I was like, oh yeah, I'm totally on board with this. Uh-huh. It's totally fine. And now whenever I use, my dad, for example, has definitely never been on board with that. Whenever I go try to use his laptop for something, I'm like, I can't fix anything.
Yep. It's, philosophically, it's really interesting because people are resistant to change, even if you think something's better. But you also, there are moments where you have to calibrate and say, yeah, this isn't for everybody. Like, I think the truth is, beyond resistance to change, how we use our phones is different. And like, right. I have an iPhone 12 mini. Like, I don't need the address bar at the bottom. It's fine, right?
Right.
If I had a Pro Max, maybe I would feel differently about it, right? But I don't. So I kind of don't care. It's okay. I mean, what the thing I like the most about that whole design is that you can swipe between tabs, because tabs were completely opaque on iPhone before. You have to tap a button to see a tab thing, and now you can just kind of flip back and forth. That's really great. That's actually my favorite thing about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like that a lot. There's other stuff in there, too, that I think is nice. I like some of the pop-up menus that you can get to by tapping and holding on the address bar. Mm-hmm. You know, tapping and holding on the reader mode brings up reader mode. Like, I think they did a decent job with it. I think it's also just, you know, there was some stuff in there that wasn't really happening. So we'll see. I'm curious to see how people, the wider phone-using populace ends up feeling about this when it eventually shows up, because I do think it will be potentially polarizing, but I also feel like, you know, some people are willing to give stuff a try. So maybe it'll catch on.
Maybe
Android will move the address bar to the bottom in their version like 2 years from now.
One more thing before we go is I did my members only story yesterday.
Yes.
About something that you and I were talking about earlier this week, which is I feel like this line has been crossed on iOS for the first time, which is Apple has two apps coming out in iOS 15, Notes and Reminders, that allow you to create smart collections on iOS. So Notes, you can create smart folders based on what tags are in a particular note. And Reminders, you can create smart lists that include tags and dates and priorities and all sorts of different filters. And I mention this because one of the knocks for a long time on a bunch of Apple's apps on iOS has been that on the Mac they have smart collection features that are not on iOS. Like the argument seemed to be philosophically iOS is just simpler and it can't worry its pretty little head over something like a smart playlist. So it's just not going to do it. I think the truth is it was probably a complicated interface and complicated to sync, and they didn't want to do it, so they just punted on it. But
sure,
the door is now open, and I wonder, I think it's funny because it feels like the Notes and Reminders teams are basically saying, we could do it. Can you do it? Because, like, smart, there should be smart albums. Photos should have smart albums on across platforms. Smart playlists should be editable across platforms. Smart mailboxes and mail, right?
Yeah.
Like, why iOS is certainly powerful enough to do this stuff. And I don't know if they will ever actually add those things, but I feel like we have to. The theory that it's not a thing that Apple wants to do has been punctured in iOS 15 because of Notes and Reminders, which I think is interesting.
It goes back to something else we discussed earlier this year, which is the stuff where we talked about breaking down the barriers a little bit because the iPad Pro now has an M1 chip in it, right?
Right.
And like, now you've lined these things up and you've convinced us this hardware is as powerful as the hardware on the Mac. Well, I don't think any believes the software is any less powerful, right? Even though it is running on a smaller device, iOS is incredibly powerful. iPadOS is incredibly powerful. The idea that it can do all this amazing stuff, like, I don't know, play videos and games and all this stuff that's very complex, but it can't handle smart albums of photos, seems a ridiculous idea on the face of it. So the more mature that the software gets, and again, let's remember, this is iOS 15. I mean, the original Mac OS wasn't even didn't last that long. Barely, right? I mean, it started in, 84 and went to, like, I don't know, early 2000s. It's getting 15 years of iOS, I guess, is my point. Built on top of software that was already fairly mature at that point.
For sure.
It's capable of doing these things. And it's the stuff that we always talk about where there's other things where it's just about choices Apple makes, right? You and I have sort of sighed over the lack of ability on the iPad to, say, record a podcast. I don't believe that the hardware or software is incapable of it. They just have chosen not to implement that, right? So it is interesting. I agree with you to see this, that sort of dam being punctured, because it does suggest, well, are people going to use this feature? And if so, are they going to demand it from other places? Or is it going to prove that well, this is still too fiddly for a lot of people who just want to use their phone for, you know, a more simple view. I'm very curious. I want to see how it works out because I love the idea. I cannot immediately think of what I would use like a smart list and reminders to do based on the way I use reminders.
Right.
But I'm intrigued to see other people come up with stuff that I might think, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. I should do it that way.
Yeah, I don't use reminders this way. But that doesn't mean, if you really are all in on reminders as your organizational system, and I think that's, I have another piece that I'm going to write, maybe for Macworld, maybe for Six Colors, haven't decided yet, it's percolating, that is about the delicate line Apple walks when it develops these apps, because, you know, Apple is not going to turn Notes into, like, Obsidian or Notion or something like that. It's not going to do that.
Right. Yeah.
And yet... that is sort of where note-taking is going. And so if you're Apple, you've got to be aware of that. But, like, that doesn't, like, they have to balance the fact that Notes is primarily used for people to put down, like, their shopping list or to write things that they're going to tweet on the internet when they make an apology for something or whatever. Those are the things.
It's one of the great things. Yeah, it's one of the great things about Notes. And frankly, you know, I think you and I were also engaged in a conversation somewhere else where somebody asked about note-taking and stuff. Like, do you use this app or that app? And I was like, I use Notes. You know why? Because... it's not fiddly, and it's everywhere.
That's basically it.
All I want to do is write something down and have it be available everywhere and not have to worry about it being saved or whatever. I use very little of the other features in Notes, but, you know, I was looking at this the other day while we were talking about the smart list stuff and some of the other Notes features, and I was like, oh, I have 776 notes in iCloud, and I have about 20 folders, and that's because I have different folders for all the different stuff. Like, if I'm taking notes for Incomparable episodes, I have a folder for that. I have a folder for my Biff episodes when I take notes for that. I have folders full of ideas for Six Colors and Macworld and writing stuff. I have a whole folder with subfolders and sub-subfolders in my writing folder. So I think, again, all the other features they've added are great, but I think they're gravy to a lot of people who are just like, I just want to write something down in Notes and I'm going to move on after that.
Yeah. Same. I've got about 762 notes in iCloud, right?
Ooh, it's like, a notes arm race.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think it's fascinating that they have to figure out with every app that Apple does that's included on their devices, like, you don't want it to be too complex, but at the same time, you know, this is a version of the Sherlocking argument, right? Which is Apple is not necessarily trying to kill your third-party app, but Apple... also wants the base system when you open it up to be good, and that means its apps need to be good. And I always view the Sherlocking thing as it's an arms race of a different kind, which is the third-party apps need to be ahead of Apple, focusing on niches of people who care about certain features that Apple is not going to implement or not going to implement for a long time, because Apple is trying to make something that has mass appeal. And if your third-party app is just filling in an obvious gap in Apple's feature set that everybody is going to want, guess what? If that's all that differentiates your app, your app's going to die. Your app's going to get Sherlocked, because an obvious hole is going to be filled by Apple in a future update. So focus on what people want to go beyond what Apple offers, and then your app is going to be okay. And so from Apple's perspective, it's the other way, which is like, where do they choose to advance the ball? Notes is never going to be Obsidian, but...
nor should it be.
Do I think that Notes is going to pay attention to that whole note-taking market and start thinking about how do we allow links between notes and stuff like that? Yes, I do. I think that they would be fools not to realize that there's something there, but they're going to do it's like a less edgy artist doing a cover of a more edgy artist's song and getting a mainstream hit out of it. Is like, Apple is never going to do Rome research, but Apple is going to like do the, oh, we see what people are kind of going for here, and there's a part of it that we can implement that will provide some of that usefulness to a larger audience, but they're never going to go do the whole thing. They're going to sand it off and make it pretty, and it's going to be
simple. You want the analogy, Jason? Yeah, I've got the analogy for it. It's the Apple, this is also timely, Apple's adaptation of Foundation, which is, don't go read the Foundation books. Trust me, just don't go read the Foundation books. But they're going to sand the edges off and make it into something that's going to be potentially a big hit with the mainstream audience who never would have gone and read the books anyways. But they looked at the books and said, ah, there's interesting stuff that we can pull from this and tell a cool story based on that. But we're going to make it a little more user-friendly.
Having read those books recently, or, you know, a few years ago for The Incomparable, I'll just say Isaac Asimov's writing style, I would call outline by credits. I like
that,
it's not,
that first book is a rough one.
It's lots of ideas, but it's and I think this was the we're bookending this episode with a lot of sort of sci-fi novel talk, but you know, it's us. The Foundation books feel very much like I've got a lot of ideas and I will hang them on some characters who move through the scenes to do what I want them to do. But it's very much not what you would expect from a modern storytelling approach. And that's why I'm, as somebody who's read all those books, I'm very excited about the Apple TV Foundation series, because the books are really, like, the premise is amazing.
It's great. It's a great premise.
And what the trailers suggest is that the writers of Foundation also think the premise is amazing. And now they're going to tell, how do you put that in the context of a modern, expensive TV series?
How do you zoom in from something that's like a 30,000 foot view of this idea to something that's like an on the ground view? And I think, there's a lot of possibility there. And I'm glad that it's not sort of a, you know, direct. I don't think you could make a direct adaptation.
I mean, I'm not kidding. It really, Asimov's novels are very much like the source material for an outline to take into a writer's room to write a show anyway.
The adaptation would be like putting the camera on somebody and having them reading the book.
Yeah.
Or telling you about things.
Yeah. That's a groundbreaking new thing coming to Apple TV Plus, is the video audiobooks.
Video books.
It's literally the audiobook being read by somebody, and you can watch them read it. And then they drink coffee, and then they read some more. And that's it. Fun.
Yep. There you go.
All right. One housekeeping note before we go, everybody. Dan and I are both traveling next week. And so we're probably not doing a podcast next week. So we'll check back with you in 2 weeks.
I guess unless something really important happens
If something big happens, then I'll call you and we'll do a phone cast or something. Because I'm not on vacation. I'm traveling. I'm going to see my mom. So I can do it in a pinch. But I think since you're traveling and I'm traveling, we're gonna you know, it's our week off. Woo! But we'll miss you. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. And I gotta edit my Python script to make sure that if we don't do a podcast 1 week, it doesn't break. That'll be fun. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.